You're listening to TIP.
Lawrence Cunningham is one of my favorite investing-related authors for a few reasons. One, he's deeply entrenched in quality investing. Two, he's one of the most passionate people regarding social governance I've ever spoken to. Three, he has an in-depth understanding of the characteristics of a quality business. And four, he's broken down one of the most outstanding companies ever, Berkshire Hathaway. I often reread and reference his book, The Essays of Warren Buffett. It reminds me of Poor Charlie's Almanac, where you are guaranteed to get smarter each time you open the book. Not only will you become more intelligent, but you'll also pick up new insights each time you open it. Seeing as the Berkshire Annual Meeting is just around the corner, I thought it would be great to cover some of the details from this book with Lawrence and share them with you. Today, we discuss a wide variety of lessons, including Lawrence's fascination with Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway, why corporate governance is so crucial for shareholders to understand, the power of transparency, accountability, and ethical decision-making, how Warren Buffett created his shareholder letters to create a competitive advantage, a list of incredible businesses to research to understand top-notch corporate governance, the makeup of a successful incentive program, and a whole lot more. If you are as strong of a disciple of Warren Buffett as I am and enjoy learning about what makes Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway so unique, you need to listen to this episode. Now, let's get right into this week's episode with Lawrence Cunningham.
Celebrating 10 years and more than 150 million downloads. You are listening to the Investors Podcast Network. Since 2014, we studied the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected. Now, for your host, Kyle Grieve.
Welcome to the Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Grieve, and today we bring Lawrence Cunningham onto the show. Lawrence, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Kyle. Thank you.
So I had the pleasure of interviewing Lawrence way back in September last year, and it was one of my favorite chats that I've ever had on this podcast. So I'm very, very excited to have Lawrence back today. So since this episode is going to be coming out shortly before the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting, I figured that we would just go over one of Lawrence's most famous books, which is The Essays of Warren Buffett, Lessons for Corporate America. So Lawrence, what is it specifically about Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway that made you want to write this book and continue updating it?
It was about 1995, and I was a young assistant professor at a university put in charge of their corporate governance program. And my job was to conduct high impact research and highly visible conferences. And I did a couple of things that were reasonably okay, but my dean still wanted more. And I had been reading Warren's letters to shareholders, thanks to my mentor. And most people think of his letters as containing investment wisdom and advice, and surely they do. But they contain so much more, including a lot of knowledge about corporate governance, boards of directors, managerial oversight, incentive compensation, accounting, M&A, and on and on. And I thought, there's a high visibility program. And so through a network of friends, I got the proposal and gone to Warren's desk and for a symposium, for a conference, kind of what I was supposed to be doing. And to my surprise, and I guess the surprise of many others, he said yes. And so we convened the conference in October of 96. Couple hundred people in the auditorium of my university in the middle of New York City. You know, you could never do that today. I mean, you need a rock concert hall for that, but we did it right in my school, and his colleagues, well, his wife Susie was there, his son Howard, and then colleagues like Charlie Munger, the vice chair, Ajit Jain, the insurance maven, Carol Loomis, who's editor of his letters, and many others. Lou Simpson, who was the investment manager at Geico, and on and on. And my colleagues, and we just had a great intellectual debate. You know, I'd put onto the conference table selections of his letters, rearranged them by theme. And so I had panels on each of the different themes. And it was just huge fun. A lot of great ideas exchanged. I published the academic papers in a journal. And then it got this attention, wider attention in the popular press. I mean, Warren was well known in investment circles then. I mean, he was famous. He wasn't as famous as he is today, but there was interest beyond my symposium in a book. And so, and I think it was Warren's idea to actually do the book. I know it was his idea to do a series. So every 5 years, as he writes new letters and as the world changes, we update the book to weave in the new ideas and eliminate redundancies and stuff like that. And that was his idea. He said, hey, you know, every 5 years or so, you could update the book. So that's what we've done. It's just been a wonderful project.
I'm interested in just rewinding a little bit in time and just understanding your interest in governance, specifically in corporate America. What got you specifically so interested in that area?
I think of corporate governance as the guardrail for investor protection, that you could have a wonderful business, you know, making an excellent product people really need, want, people pay for, the company produces significant profits, but then without governance guardrails, all those profits can be channeled to insiders. Executive compensation and bonuses and payouts and perks and who knows what else, fees. My interest was to, you know, help maintain and support a system that would be owner-oriented, that would be protecting shareholder investments. And it's one of the things that I loved about Warren's letters and this book is that it demonstrates that investors, obviously, you have to conduct fundamental valuation analysis and examine the business case, but you have to have a section in that analysis on governance, on how will the shareholders be protected. Because I've been involved with companies that were wonderful businesses, but the shareholders didn't receive most of the result of that because of managerial leakage, let's call it. So that was my interest. I think it's a fascinating subject on its own, but the real purpose is to protect investors, protect shareholders.
So one thing that I really liked from the intro of your book was that you talked about how Buffett places a very high degree of importance on forthrightness and candor in his communications with shareholders. So you also pointed out how simple he makes the annual reports and how he likes to make sure he uses simple terms, simple language and numbers that, you know, anybody can probably understand. So I'm interested in understanding if you think that this structure of his annual report has been some sort of competitive advantage for Berkshire Hathaway.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Most CEOs today and for decades have professionals write their letters and their communications, press releases, and other public speeches. And it's obvious how these things have been produced. They have a sense of scriptedness. They're often elliptic or foggy or written in PR speak. And it's hard to do what Buffett does, which is to sit down. I mean, it takes him hundreds of hours during the last quarter of the year to produce this. Writing is a difficult art under any circumstances. And here you're trying to capture and explain performance over a year, and especially in his case, a lot of different businesses, a lot of different engines. And then you try to put it in the context, not only of that particular year, but the arc of the company and its operating environment. So it's painful. It's hard to do what he's done. I can understand why a lot of CEOs just outsource it to the professionals and they might add their little touch. But to do it yourself and to really put the effort that he does has value because it conveys the real essence of a company, the culture, especially if it's the founder who's writing these letters, what DNA that person has injected into the company. So it becomes a very distinctive expression of who the company is. And that will be a distinction. And if it's a positive distinction, it'll be a competitive advantage. And so it certainly is, as Warren, as you said, he tries to explain it in such crooner language. He makes a joke that his audience, any writer has to think, for whom am I writing? What's the reception going to be like? He imagines that he's writing his letter to his sister, a smart person, but not an expert. And so, yeah, the accounting concepts are explained in very accessible language. It's not dumbed down. It's written for smart people, you know, intelligent people, but not a CPA or an MBA necessarily. And I think that, so yes, he was good at this from the beginning. He took the care and the effort. You know, in his early days, he was writing investment annual reports to the small number of partners that were in his partnership. I might have been a dozen friends and family, including his sister, where, you know, he had to be very, very personal, very thoughtful, very deliberate, very honest. And he just carried that into the public company and has been doing it now for 50 plus years. And there's no question that it's a competitive advantage. It's also, like most competitive advantages, it's not an easy thing to do, but he does it very well.
You're on the board of Markel, Constellation Software, and Kelly Partners Group, all of them, which I noticed have very good social governance. So I'm interested in knowing if you can suggest some other businesses that also have good corporate governance that listeners to the show and probably myself should spend some time learning more about.
Yes, well, thank you. I am on those three boards. I think those companies are wonderful companies led by outstanding executives. And indeed, not coincidentally, I did some research on, I like how you call it, good social governance. And, you know, this that sense that the CEO should be a partner to his or her shareholders and write to them in using, you know, his own time and effort and attention, writing that very carefully. And all of those guys, all the CEOs of those companies do that. And I had done a bunch of research on the quality of shareholder letters using linguistic analytic tools, you know, that test for candor versus obfuscation. And I did other research just around rankings of letters and stuff like that. And I did a whole report on that. And then I decided, and I ranked them. And those companies whose board I sit are at the top of that. And then I turned around and published a book, a collection of the best shareholder letters from about 15 CEOs. And so it's those companies plus, and Warren is at the top of that deck. And the others I put in there, just to answer your question of examples, I think I'd cite Fairfax Financial, run by the CEO and founder is Prem Watsa. Like Markel, it's in the insurance business. In fact, it was actually a part of Markel when Prem Watsa bought it. And like Constellation, it's based in Toronto. Wonderful company. Prem is a very clear, candid writer, tells it like it is. Not every year is great. Buy and hold that. Well, if you look back, it's been a very successful business and investment over decades and decades. Another one I featured in that book is called Credit Acceptance Corporation, not a household name, but a very important player in the funding of automobile purchases, making loans, supporting the market for loans, especially the people who might not otherwise be able to get a loan. Just again, it's an interesting business, and the leadership is just, you know, clear, candid. I could go on and on. It is a competitive advantage. It's a small number who stand out in this way, but it's not 10. It's 30 or 40. And you can check out Dear Shareholders if you want, or other of my books discuss other examples.
Yeah, that book, Dear Shareholders, is awesome. I have it as well. I highly recommend it. It's a really good compilation where, you basically just found all the interesting tidbits and you went back in history, right? Like I really, really enjoyed what you talked about with Roberto Goizetta and Coca-Cola, it was really, really well done.
Oh yeah. He was an artist and went through again. Coca-Cola is always seen as this wonderful, wonderful company. Nothing is inevitable about it. I mean, and Roberto did a great job steering it through some challenges, focused on owner interest, on shareholder value. He minted concepts around that idea and wrote clearly about them. That's a real master.
So there is an interesting passage in your book about how Warren distinguishes between growth and value. So you wrote, quote, "Many professionals make another common mistake. Buffett notes by distinguishing between growth investing and value investing. Growth and value, Buffett says, are not distinct. They're integrally linked since growth must be treated as a component of value," unquote. So the interesting thing here is that Buffett wasn't originally focused much on growth in his investing process at the beginning. He was laser focused on value. So I'm interested, can you discuss some of the major influences that helped him evolve from being, you know, a very, very value focused investor to being more of a growthy, quality focused investor that he is today?
Yeah, it's an interesting evolution. I think Warren learned one key thing about Warren is, and about a lot of your listeners probably, they believe in learning. They believe in getting new information, developing new knowledge, adapting as the hand they're playing changes or as the card game changes. And that's what Warren is, I think, trying to get people to appreciate the importance of evolving. And his early phase was mostly thanks to his professor, his teacher, Ben Graham, the father of, call it value investing if you want, but the idea that you should pay a price that is a deep discount from the value you're getting. Ben Graham called that the margin of safety, because prone to error, so try to be super careful in what you pay. And Warren took that idea literally in his early decades in an application called cigar butt investing, meaning that, well, you know, you could buy just the last little bit of a cigar. If you get it for cheap, you could make a big buck, you know, from that. And in terms of the influences that evolved him away from that, one was Charlie Munger. I mentioned his business partner beginning in early 70s, late 60s. And Charlie thought that's an attractive approach if you're in it for the short term and or if you're just buying a bunch of small things, buy them cheap. Okay, you'll make some money and move along. But he said to Warren, you know, if you're thinking you're going to be in this enterprise for decades and decades, for, you know, half a century, that's not going to work. You're going to want things that will last over decades and decades. You need a whole big giant cigar, maybe a cigar box. You can't just have this butt. And he said, you know, if you're going to do that, you're not going to find lots of those little cheap things running around. So Munger encouraged Warren to think about growth, to use that phrase, but it was really about, well, think about the durability of a business, how it can grow, be sustained over very long periods of time. And so he wanted them to focus on the intangibles, the moats, the competitive advantages, customer franchise, brand loyalty, and be willing, you know, you still want a margin of safety. He didn't give up on that idea, but be willing to pay a little more for value, for quality. And so that was a primary influence, you know, Charlie sort of sitting there and coaching. And the second influence intellectually was the book by Phil Fisher, came out in around 1958. So it was sort of popular as Charlie's given Warren this advice. Phil's book was called Common Stocks and Uncommon Profits. And it had this sense of what we would now probably call quality investing, which was, look, okay, don't overpay for things. Don't violate Ben Graham's margin of safety principle, but don't take it to cigar butt extremes either. You can pay up for value. And that's what I call that quality investing. I think, so the nicknames growth investing and value investing, I think they got a little dichotomized, you know, and sort of a false dichotomy. And that's what Warren was just trying to correct. He's like, look, they're not really alternatives. If you're doing value investing, yeah, you want a margin of safety, but when you're making the valuation estimate, you're going to include some, you know, what's the growth prospects? And so I like quality investing as a way to capture that combination.
So you wrote, quote, since 1978, Buffett has always written his letters with a specific purpose, to attract what he calls quality shareholders, those who buy large stakes and stick around, neither thoroughly diversified indexers nor short-term traders. So I'd like to rewind back to March of 2000. At this period, Berkshire Hathaway had reached a multi-year low of $41,300, down from a high of $80,900 just a few short years earlier. So it would appear that during bubbles, even quality shareholders are willing to dump their quality businesses to chase returns in other stocks. I'm interested in knowing if you think that Warren has been able to improve on his ability to retain quality shareholders since then, or do you think that the right kind of bubble is just going to negate the positive effects of quality shareholders?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right about that. Look, being a quality shareholder, by which Buffett has defined them, and I've redefined it as a long-term and focused investor. Having those two characteristics is fiendishly difficult. And it was hard in 1978. It was maybe even harder in 2000. I think it's even harder in 2024, you know, in terms of being long-term. Even then, there was pressure to meet a quarterly result. There was pressure to just human behavioral pressure to see returns faster rather than slower. So it was hard to be patient then. But then, you know, imagine, take 2000, the internet period, the pace of daily life changed. You started to move into, you know, you could very quickly just click and purchase goods and be delivered the next day from across the world. And we'll forward into 2020, social media just delivers everything instantaneously. The pace of innovation is extremely rapid. You know, social media intensifies this sort of instantaneity of stuff. And that's bound to affect people's patience in investing too. The idea of let's find this nice little business and maybe after 3, 7, or 12 years, it'll be this wonderful super duper business. Being able to do that, it's gotten harder. I think it was harder then. I think it's harder now. So being patient, okay, that prong of being a quality shareholder, there are going to be fewer people who are able to do it. And then on the focus side, in 1978, there weren't really any index funds. Jack Bogle had begun talking about it and writing about it a little bit in college around that time, but they were really incubated the next decade or two and then took off really in the last, since around 2000. So, you know, now you have gobs and gobs, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars, you know, massive percentages of the total market capital are deployed through index funds where no one's picking a stock, picking a basket maybe, and then the purchases and sales are simply done as the market basket amounts change. And so no one's picking this one of Berkshire stock. They have to buy the Class B because it's in some index. So the proportion of investors who are focused has declined. And even the ones who aren't officially indexed, there's a lot of closet indexing. So they 80 stocks. So you're right. The percentage of the shareholders of any company that are quality shareholders has declined massively since 1978 as short-termers and indexers have risen. And that's certainly even been true of Berkshire Hathaway. That said, it's been less true of Berkshire Hathaway than any other company. We crunched the numbers on the types of shareholders in Russell 2000 or so, and Berkshire is way at the top in terms of proportion of its overall shareholder base that are, you know, long-term in focus compared to the short-termers and the indexers. It has a lot of those, but less than others. And I think Warren's education, his letters, that audience is a big part of it. He has consciously cultivated that cohort, and they've responded largely. Again, they're obviously the big indexers own big chunks of Berkshire, but he has, I think, succeeded in attracting a disproportionate share of that shrinking base. And you could see it, you know, you could see it in Omaha at the annual meeting. You can see it on podcasts like these. He has led a large group of investors who are inclined to be patient and focused and has, I mean, his current letter actually said his shareholder list, he's got 3 million accounts. And I haven't broken them down this year, but I would say the overwhelming majority of those are quality shareholders.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Our friends at Corient provide wealth management services centered around you. Corient's goal is to exceed your expectations and simplify your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. They are one of the largest integrated fee-only U.S. registered investment advisors, and Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. They have extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. The teams at Corient put the collective power of their expertise into building you the custom wealth, investment, and family office solutions that can help you reach your holistic financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, speak with an advisor today at Corient.com. That's spelled Corient.com. That's Corient.com. When Rain Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rain was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and you feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what's happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what's happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools that I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I read each morning to kick off my day to stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
So Warren has commonly referred to helpers in the investing industry who he does not hold in very high regard. So he understands very well that many of these helpers are offering their services for high prices, yet offer little to no value. To reinforce his point, he wagered $500,000 over a decade to investment professionals who could beat the results of a low-cost Vanguard S&P fund. So none of the five funds came even close to beating the index. I'm interested in knowing, why do you think Warren has taken responsibility himself to show investors that buying index funds is a rational choice? And do you think he just does this for his amusement, or is it you know, something that's part of his DNA?
I think it's part of his DNA. I think you're exactly right about that, Kyle. And the helpers label, that's he's got a wonderful essay. One of the essays in the essays of Warren Buffett is about the helpers. It actually features another cool name. He imagines a family, a single family that owns all of corporate America, and he calls those family the Got Rocks. Got Rocks, like old-fashioned way of, you know, rich people. And he's got them with, you know, just this enormous capital base that they get to hand down generation to generation. And if they just did that without paying anything out of it, it would be this gargantuan number. But what happens is after one generation, like, do a little better, so they hire some people to help them do a little better, that actually subtracts costs, incurs fees. It actually doesn't make them any better. So the next generation tries to hire some additional people to try to explain why they aren't doing so well. And that doesn't help, but the next generation decides to get some additional helpers to figure out why the help isn't helping, and on and on. It's an amusing parable, and you're right, it displays his passion for this critical, you know, it's criticism of the asset management or fund industry that he is passionately critical, where overall the fees are higher than the value conferred. And so there's a great book by a guy named Fred Schwed back in the 30s. I'm not sure exactly when it was published. It's a classic. And the title is, Where Are the Customers' Yachts? You know, he's like walking down the yacht. All the bankers, all the helpers are traveling in these wonderful boats. And what do the customers have a boat? So why is Warren, you know, I think it is in his DNA. He is by nature a very thrifty person. You know, he doesn't pay extra for anything. And that would certainly, you know, even a hamburger, but that would certainly include a financial advisor or a merger broker or a consultant at Berkshire. They use very few of those helpers. I mean, they have a law firm to help them with taxes, regulations, and acquisition agreements. They have an accounting firm to audit the books and maintain the internal controls. So, but they're otherwise, he's extremely reluctant to pay fees. And that's just part of his personality. I think, you know, DNA, and also being from Omaha, just Nebraska, the middle of America, very thrifty culture. So I think that's a big part of it. And then the related part is he does care deeply about his investors. And again, they started out as friends and family, partners. And he looked out for, you know, any penny that he paid was a penny come out of their pocket. And he still feels that way about Berkshire Hathaway, this, you know, $500 billion company. They pay, you know, a 1% fee for this acquisition. He feels like that's coming out of the pockets of all my shareholders, of all the Berkshire shareholders, and he treats his money like theirs, the company's money, like it's their money, because it really is. So it's DNA, and then it's cultural within Berkshire Hathaway. And I think that basically explains almost all of it. I would also observe that, you know, when he's in that Got Rocks essay, he's talking about the overall industry for sure, but then he singles out a couple of elements of it, including private equity. And that's fine. I've seen them charge very high fees. I get that. But one, the cynic or the people in that community might say, look, Warren is just being a competitor. So we're trying to buy the same companies he is. And, you know, he wants to say, look, if you come with me, we're not going to charge you board fees or strategy fees or consulting fees. We're lean and mean and thrifty. Those PE guys are going to charge you money at every step of the way. So there's maybe one small part. You know, it's Berkshire is a very attractive home for sellers of businesses. And one reason is they don't charge fees. But so I think that there may be some, Warren is, if not, in addition to all the other things we've been talking about, he is a consummate salesman and he's always selling Berkshire Hathaway in every market that it's in. And one of those markets is competing with private equity for businesses. And so to emphasize that that's a costly bunch of helpers, it's consistent with Berkshire's own interests. If I can finish your question, Kyle, the attractiveness of index investing, because that's the place in the essays where he's got the Gottrock story is about, why ordinary investors in America are better off with a cheap index fund, with an index fund that doesn't charge any of those fees, or charges extremely low fee because they're not doing anything. They're just buying the basket. There's no advice. There's no strategy. There's no consulting. He's explaining why an index fund is good to most people because it's cheap. You get the market return and no real cost. Whereas, if you're hiring a stock picker to give you all this help, don't expect much. That's the context in which he's discussing that. And I take him at his word. I think for decades, he has advised ordinary people that don't have the time or the ability or the inclination to study businesses in order to intelligently select stocks. He's been advising them for decades, just buy an index. And he calls them the rocking chair investor, the armchair investor. Just, you don't have to do anything quite well because America is a prosperous country and economy. So I think he absolutely stands by that advice. At the same time, he has invested enormously in educating people about intelligent stock selection. So he knows people, even if they index a lot of their portfolio or net worth, they're going to be picking stocks too. And he's fine with that. He encourages that. I mean, he wants people to buy Berkshire Hathaway stock and then wants them to hold it. I think it's an interesting thing about Warren that he is an advocate for index funds, but at the same time, he's educating people on stock picking, on a complete investment philosophy.
So one area that you touched on with that response was just paying fees for M&A. So obviously, Berkshire Hathaway is a very acquisitive company. They've done tons of deals for their subsidiaries. And I think part of his competitive advantage is, he's not, and this kind of just goes into what you just talked about all these hidden fees and these helpers, is that when he makes a deal, he doesn't need to have an army of people coming in there that he's paying to help make a deal. A lot of times he just goes and meets the owner, shakes their hand, bang, it's done. I mean, that has to be a major competitive advantage for him in Berkshire Hathaway.
Absolutely. I think the principle of autonomy that Berkshire offers, that is that managers of the Berkshire businesses get to call their own operational shots in product mix, pricing, employee policies, retention, bonuses, promotions, expansion, contraction. It's really all up to them. There's some limits on, the retirement plan or deploying large amounts of capital. But so a manager who likes that independence, that ability, that autonomy, prizes Berkshire as a home. And that's really been the path for a lot of the Berkshire acquisitions. Someone who still wanted to run the business and run it their way, but didn't want some of the other anxieties. Either it was a public company, they don't want that reporting anymore, like Clayton Homes, or it's a family company and they're kind of at an inflection point with a generational shift or facing that. So they want to secure a home for the next generation. And so that's been a real attraction of sellers to Berkshire. There are other companies who have mimicked that, but it's a real plus. And on the flip side, I'm not against private equity. I think they do a fabulous job, but they do tend to intervene more. And part of what they're offering is, the other thing about Berkshire is they don't have anybody that they could send in to actually make those changes if they were needed. Warren is sitting in Omaha with a couple dozen mostly financial people. He's got some business geniuses who can troubleshoot, but that's not their preferred approach. They like an existing business. It's run really well. and just will be able to continue to perform and maybe even grow as a result of the Berkshire affiliation. You know, private equity, they have tools and people who can diagnose problems and help fix them. And that usually, and very often includes managerial leadership, but could be the product mix and the customer base and everything else about a business. And what they're selling or what they're offering is quite different from what Berkshire is offering. And so in some ways, they end up sometimes competing for the same business, but ideally, most of the sellers would be at home in one setting and less at home in the other.
So Warren Buffett listed a few lessons in one of the essays that you shared in your book that he and Charlie learned over 25 years. So one of them really stood out to me, and this was, quote, after 25 years of buying and supervising a great variety of businesses, Charlie and I have not learned how to solve difficult business problems, unquote. So then he went on to say, you know, they're trying to win by stepping over 1 foot hurdles rather than 7-footers. So I'd love to know some examples of when Warren has attempted to stray from this strategy and how he came ultimately to this conclusion of jumping over 1 foot hurdles.
It's a great passage. Yeah, and he was reflecting. That's a great essay because it was a couple decades ago, but it was still after 25 years of working, of making purchase decisions, both in individual stocks and in whole companies. And, you know, I think overall the record is very strong. They made way more wise capital deployment decisions than stupid ones. But nevertheless, one of the lessons is to learn from the stupid things you did. And he's in that essay, he's diagnosing, it's like, one of the things we did, and this again, contrast to private equity, Warren thought, you know, I personally, Warren, I'm not good at solving difficult business problems. Maybe there's some geniuses in private equity who are, but I'm not good at that. It's really hard to do. And neither is Charlie. And so our best strategy, instead of trying to buy those turnarounds and fix them, we're going to try to avoid them and try to just get the simpler ones. And Charlie had a wonderful quote along these lines too. They thought very much alike. But Charlie said, well, as you go through life, it's more important just to make a few good decisions and avoid making the stupid ones. And it's often harder to avoid making the stupid ones. And stupid in this context is those 7-footers. You know, and so, I mean, Warren, he'd have a list. I think there's a list in that essay of some of the 7-footers that had difficult business problems that he couldn't fix and maybe weren't even fixable. You know, the original classic was his acquisition of the original Berkshire Hathaway business, which was a dying textile business up in Massachusetts, you know, at a time when the beginning of globalization and of making fabrics and textiles abroad and shipping them around the world, including to America, so that you couldn't have the pricing power. So it was a dying industry, and he stuck with it, but and he also had the union group to deal with. So it was maybe a doomed business, and he tried to keep it alive for God, at least a decade, and he realized he couldn't. He finally shut it down. So it was a terrible business, and he learned a big lesson. Another one, though, I mean, but he didn't learn it immediately or permanently, because then maybe a decade after that, he bought a shoe company called Dexter Shoe, and actually a similar horizon facing it, where just shoe companies, you could manufacture the same shoe in Asia, bring it back across the oceans for a fraction, a tenth of what it would cost to do in New England. So he learned a lesson again. And in that one, in that transaction, it wasn't just a big business problem he couldn't jump over, but he also used Berkshire Hathaway stock to buy Dexter. And so just year by year, he saw as Berkshire stock increased in value and that shoe company deteriorated, he saw how much he wasted. So another big 7-footer that I think he missed, he didn't really see, I think Charlie did, was Jen Ray, one of the biggest acquisitions they've ever made. Even now, I think it was $27 billion around 1998 or so. So these would be much bigger numbers now. But what Warren obviously was attracted to, its wonderful book of business and reinsurance. It was a large global carrier, a player in that field, abundant float at appealing cost. Charlie was concerned. He said, but they're also writing all these derivative contracts, these hedging instruments. They look too complicated to me. I can't understand them. I don't see. And that feels like a risk. You know, it feels like a potential 7-footer. Not positive it's a 7-footer, but it doesn't look like a 1-footer. And Warren Warren went forward with it anyway, and Charlie was right. Those it had extensive derivative products that blew up and cost a fortune, and it took years to unwind. Every year in Warren's letter during that period, it's about a 6-year period, he's classifying the costs in money and brain damage. You could fix it. It was just a series of bad business decisions and set of business problems, but it took an enormous effort. So I think, it's a nice analogy too, that it might be fun and exciting to try to hit those 7-footers. And some people may be really good at it. Again, the private equity world. You have to know your strengths, and fixing businesses just isn't one of his strengths. And even, there's a little bit of modesty in there, because he certainly owned businesses that had challenges and that through selecting the right managers, they were fixed. But he's right. Obviously it is a lot easier if you can find the 1-footers.
So looking at the opposite end of the spectrum is obviously the 1-footer. So I'm interested in knowing, obviously there's probably tons and tons of 1-footers that he's crossed, but in your opinion, what are the investments that just made the most sense to Warren Buffett that have obviously been some of his biggest successes that we know about today?
I think, it's the See's Candies, chocolate confectioner with deep brand loyalty and therefore some significant pricing power. Geico, the car insurance company that had built out a wonderful underwriting discipline and staff with the very thrifty, very cost-conscious, disciplined group. Maybe it wasn't a 1-footer because they did face problems that most insurance companies do. Maybe it's a 2-footer. It's hard to find the 1-footers, even in his case. I mean, you might count Dairy Queen, Justin Boots, and Acme Bricks. I think in Clayton Homes, maybe that's a 2-footer because they face business adversity of various kinds because of the markets that they serve, people who with at the lower end of the net worth or income matrix, so they encounter challenges in that business. I think the key, if I rephrase his kind of test and say that you need to have a good business, kind of doesn't have that many problems. Maybe it's a 2-footer, 1-footer. And then you really have to have a good manager who is capable of handling adversity when it comes. And I think that's one of the maybe derivative lesson of what he's talking about here is he knows that he personally is not gifted at solving thorny business problem. And so he tries to avoid, that's one of the reasons for the autonomous structure at Berkshire. Warren really knows it. He's really not good at pricing insurance, but he knows that his head of insurance, Ajit Jain, is. So he just has Ajit do it and tries not to second guess him. He's really good at picking jockeys, but not actually riding the horse. And I think that's a big part of what he means when he's reviewing that lesson that he and Charlie learned. They're really good investors. They're not particularly good managers.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Long Angle is a private network dedicated to identifying and accessing the best private market investment opportunities. Long Angle is a vetted community of 3,000 very high net worth investors who manage more than $40 billion in assets. Members leverage their collective experience and scale to access and underwrite some of the world's best alternative investments. Diligence teams made up of members who have spent a career in each asset class underwrite every opportunity. Deals range from private equity, search funds, and private credit to secondaries, venture, and energy. Long Angle does not charge membership fees, but does require an interview and validation of investable assets. Long Angle is a community of investors, not a wealth manager. Members are treated as partners on every deal, with full transparency to diligence and underwriting. All members receive equal access to negotiated fee discounts. For more information and to apply for membership, visit longangle.com. That's longangle.com. Today's show is sponsored by public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear, upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
All right, back to the show.
So Buffett had a really good quote on share repurchases, which was this. So, quote, "My suggestion, before even discussing repurchases, a CEO and his or her board should stand, join hands, and in unison declare what is smart at one price and stupid at another," unquote. So I'd love to get your input on why this seems like such a hard task for the majority of corporations to execute on.
It's troubling because it should be fundamental. That statement there should be so well known, so ingrained, that you don't have to have the standing commitment that he encourages. You know, in this sentence that you quoted, it's in an essay that it's 10 pages on the rationality of share repurchases. And the idea that rationality depends on the price. Like anything, you could over or underpay for anything, including a company in its own stock. And if underpay, that's good for the continuing shareholders. If you overpay, that's bad for them. It's fundamental. Why do we need a seance, to have that gathering? I do think a significant reason, part of the problem, is insufficient appreciation of the basics of capital allocation in American C-suites and boardrooms. Capital allocation it's a fundamental concept. I think every business person ought to know it cold, and every director ought to know it cold, so that we don't have to, again, have that scene of unity. But what I'd like to see them do is, any director, before assuming the board seat, be able to recite the basic ABCs of capital allocation. And it's simple. Every dollar in this company ought to be put to its best use. And there are only three or four uses. One is reinvesting in the existing businesses. Another is acquiring new businesses. And then the third or fourth is paying dividends to shareholders and or repurchasing the stock. And that's it. That's the mix. And they're not necessarily exclusive. You can do all of them, and it's not necessarily linear. But you should evaluate each of these deployment avenues and then determine what's the best allocation mix. And that's what every director ought to think that way, ought to know that. And every executive should too. But not all of them do. A lot of executive capital allocation is a concept that's taught in finance and ingrained in the finance function in a corporation. Investors know it cold. Your listeners would. But, not all CEOs come up majoring in finance or through the finance ranks. They may be great at marketing or product development or management leadership, or they may be scientists, good at research and development and getting approvals and stuff like that. And they just haven't encountered this idea of capital allocation. Likewise with board members, they're chosen for all sorts of skills, the skills I just mentioned. Maybe they're good at marketing or branding or leadership or coaching. They may be good at helping others. Fellow executives prosper. They may be good at science or government regulations or shareholder relations, or these days, climate science or cybersecurity, and may not have had exposure to finance and capital allocation. I like Warren's, meeting. Let's have 12 people say what's good at one price is dumb at another price. I'd also like them to say, before I take the CEO job, I can state the ABCs of capital allocation. Before I join the board, I can state the ABCs of capital allocation. And then, you know, and it shouldn't be terribly hard. And so I'll stop there, Kyle. But I think, you know, this question of the repurchase, it's a relatively simple idea and has been obscured. And the simplest idea is the one he's making there. It's a good investment if you can buy it low, not a good investment if you buy it high.
So another problem that we run into, especially this happened a lot during the beginning of COVID, was companies basically just borrowing money to buy back shares. So I'm just interested in knowing, you know, let's say you were on a board of an imaginary company and the company proposed to do a buyback, what would you look at specifically on a balance sheet to make sure that it would make sense then and that you're not putting undue risk just in the sake of doing buybacks?
Well, right. I'd think about the buyback decision as analogous to the dividend decision. And you know, they're both deployments of capital back to the shareholders, slightly different route. You know, one is it's optional to the holders, the other is everyone gets the payment. But I'd think about whether to do it or the capacity to do it in for buybacks the same way I would about dividends. That is, what would happen after giving effect to this distribution? Do we have, you know, and think about my capital allocation matrix. Do we have sufficient liquid resources to not only meet our obligations as they come due, but maintain our existing competitive position and sustain it as we wish to do? And do we have sufficient capital resources to seize acquisition opportunities that might come our way or we expect to come our way? So if we have sufficient capital to deploy for those two allocation avenues, then one of these allocation avenues, dividends or buybacks, would be prudent. And then I don't really well understand the idea of, well, let's borrow money to effectuate this. I think this is a question of deploying the capital that's owned, not incurring debt in order to do it.
One of the most powerful quotes from the book on intrinsic value was, quote, "The speed at which a business's success is recognized, furthermore, is not that important as long as the company's intrinsic value is increasing at a satisfactory rate. In fact, delayed recognition can be an advantage. It may give us the chance to buy more of a good thing at a bargain price," unquote. So as anyone who follows Berkshire knows that he likes using book value to kind of track the intrinsic value of Berkshire Hathaway. But if we look at other companies such as Apple, which is obviously a business that Berkshire owns a lot, it doesn't quite work out the same way. So, you know, I just did some quick math on it. In the last decade, Apple's share price is appreciated at about 17% compounded annually, but book value is actually decreased by a compound annual rate of 0.01%. So it basically hasn't moved. So obviously in the case of Apple, looking at earnings per share or free cash flow per share is going to be a better proxy for tracking that intrinsic value of the business. So my question for you is, how does Warren differentiate between which quantitative metrics he's going to use to track the intrinsic value of a company, other than, of course, Berkshire Hathaway?
I think he says often in the essays that the ultimate valuation is intrinsic value. That's it's easy to state. It's the discounted cash flows that the business or the investment will generate from now to the end of time. So, okay, that's easy to say, but it's very difficult to map out what those cash flows are and then to determine the right discount rate. So intrinsic value is the thing, but it can't be, it's unlikely even two people would agree on any given investment that this is the intrinsic value. And so all we have are indirect approximations or tools that can help probe or test one's estimate. And book value is one. You mentioned earnings per share. Free cash flow per share or others, we could tinker with all those, make an adjusted book value or adjusted earnings per share or free cash flow defined in different ways or just cash flow. We could look at market price and could be either at the moment or over a period. So, and this Munger always talked about having the right tool for the job. He imagined that we all have a toolkit. We have a toolbox with lots of different tools in it, and that we need to pick the right one. And so these are valuation tools, and what will be most useful and reliable in an estimation will vary with the business. He had a wonderful joke. He said, he must have said thousands of times in his life, he said, to the man or to the person with a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And he said, that's a really stupid way to solve a problem, right? So I think it would be incorrect to think, well, I will always use book value as my tracker, or always use free cash flow, or even say something like, I'll use book value for an old-fashioned industrial company and free cash flow for, you know, a modern tech company with no tangible assets. It, you know, it might be directionally okay, but it's still you're not quite finding the best tool for the job. And I think what, you know, what with Warren and book value, you know, even for Berkshire, I mean, he still, I think, uses it for lots of purposes. But a few years ago, for when it was, he, and in the essays, he talks about how, you know, look, I've been telling you, like Kyle just did for decades, that I'm going to, the first sentence in every annual report for going back to the 70s was, our gain in book value or our loss was X. And he stopped doing that, I'm not sure when, maybe 5 years ago. And he said, I still book value going to be useful for a lot of things, but it's, yes, less useful than it used to be for Berkshire because our mix of owned businesses and equities has changed a lot. The accounting that goes into determining book value for those two different buckets are different. And also we've been doing lots of buybacks, and that's going to actually increase intrinsic value per share, but decrease the book value per share. So for all these reasons, he said, I'm not going to use that as the primary tracker anymore. It's still useful for lots of purposes, but that tool, you know, so he had to adjust for what purpose that tool is still useful. And so, you know, we could probably go through sort of company by company or investment by investment and think, well, what is the best tool, or how would Buffett determine the best tool for the job? But it is, I think that's probably the key thing, right? That I don't think he thinks there is some universal metric for every context, you know. And my own thinking on this is that it's most useful to design, to approach the valuation estimate in a few different ways, and then draw some sort of a implicit consensus among them, and then rely on things like, okay, I need to have a margin of safety, and or okay, I have some reasonable grounds to estimate that there's growth, there's high quality, that there's good corporate governance, and therefore I can pay up. So I think it's an excellent question, and I think it takes that whole toolbox.
I really loved how you dedicated a lot of pages in the book to retained earnings. So I think retained earnings are one of the most underutilized line items on a company's balance sheet. And, you know, that one number tells you just so much about what management has done with the money of shareholders and their ability to create value with that money. So Buffett said many years ago that, quote, the five-year test should be one, during the period did our book value gain exceed the performance of the S&P? And two, did our stock consistently sell at a premium to book, meaning that every dollar of retained earnings was always worth more than a dollar? If these tests are met, retaining earnings has made sense, unquote. So I'm just interested in knowing if you can discuss how Warren has used retained earnings. And, you know, he hasn't talked about it in quite a few years. So I'm just interested in knowing, kind of like you just said with book value, is he still using that kind of internally in his own mind, but not necessarily sharing it with shareholders?
It's a great question. And that passage incidentally appears, it's on page 23 of the essays, and it comes from the owner's manual, the Berkshire Hathaway owner's manual that he published in around 1998, which contains 15 owner-related business principles. It's very short, sweet. It's sort of like a constitution, you know, for a country. So here in the essays, it's just six pages, and it's essentially the first six pages of the book. So that, when that happens, that's number nine. And so I would say, to take your last question first, that yes, you know, he still believes this approach or this perspective is a way to test the value of the retained, of the decision to retain a retain each dollar. I think my answer would be yes, because I think if he changed it, he'd be very explicit to change it in here. In fact, he also says in that same passage that, hey, I've been saying this for decades, but I realized in 2009, it has to be, as you just said, a rolling five-year average. It can't be static because you might miss it, but you should be looking at this over 5 years. What he's getting at, you know, it's a fundamental thing, like you say. Okay, retained earnings are an overlooked feature business because it's inherent compounding, right? It's the manager is keeping that dollar and it's redeployed. It's not being paid out. It's being redeployed in that business. And so you're going to automatically, you should automatically get some compounding out of that. And so what Warren is saying is the only way I'm going to keep, it's only fair for me to keep that dollar is if I can do more with it than you can. And that's what he's trying to get at. And then, you know, how do you figure that out? I mean, so, but that's the intuition is we will, and look, he's also defending Berkshire's historical policy of not paying dividends. It has done a lot of repurchases, and we've discussed that a little bit, but it's never paid, it paid one dividend once 50 plus years ago. So it's got this policy of retaining its earnings. And so in this passage, you know, he's trying, in this constitution, he's trying to say, you know, and I'm only going to do that, I'm only going to keep doing that, is if the company can do better with the dollar than you can. And then he tries to give this two-part test that you explain that, you know, compares the, you know, he's very, very explicit that he's saying when he measures what I can do with it versus what you can do with it, it's whether you shareholders get at least a dollar of market value, right? And so he compares our book value to the market premium to our book value. And he compares it, our change in book value to the return on the S&P. So he's trying to have a market reference for his own performance. And to me, just going back to your very first question, the candor here, right on the opening pages is, here's our policy and here's our breakpoint. And what's wonderful about that, or what's special about that, is not everyone explains that. You know, you open lots of CEO letters and you're not going to have a test at all. I mean, the better ones will at least say, look, there are four different things we could do with the capital, and one of them is dividends or buy back the stock, and here's how we think. You get some very good companies who do that, but tons of them do not. And even among those who do, that the breakpoint test that he's giving is far more informative, you know, what you see. But it's a fabulous question.
One of my favorite points of emphasis that Buffett talks about when assessing a manager's performance is to look at their achievements, not necessarily in terms of, you know, total shareholder return, but in terms of return on equity. When you pair a business that doesn't require much leverage with a manager of a business who has this track record of having a high and sustainable ROE, I mean, that's a pretty clear indication that they're skilled at capital allocation, which you obviously discussed a lot this episode. So there are businesses that do exist that incentivize managers on capital efficiency metrics, but it seems pretty rare. I'm interested in knowing, you know, why do you think businesses utilize some of these weaker incentives, such as revenue growth or appreciation in total shareholder value, for incentives which can often misalign, you know, the managers with shareholders?
I mean, you might have just hit it, that, you know, it takes an owner-oriented person or a shareholder-oriented person to measure themselves based on the return to the holders. And so I'd like to see more of it. I agree with you. There are wonderful companies that do pay based on return on equity or return on invested capital or other metrics that are shareholder level defined. Whereas growth in revenue, I mean, there are shrinkers out there, but many companies will tend to grow without the manager lifting a finger. And some growth will actually not result in good margins and good returns for the holder. So I think, you know, you should be extremely careful about incentivizing growth for growth's sake, a combination of a bonus off the growth and a bonus for return on equity might be optimal. Some mix. It depends on the business, depends on its market and its propensity to grow or the desirability of shrinking. So some mix. But as for why, I think it's, you know, it's an insufficient focus on the shareholder. You know, along the lines we've been talking about, that managers and directors, you know, haven't all come up through the lens of the shareholder. And I think that's gotten even more out of whack in the past 5 or 10 years, where lots of other interests are asserting a priority. And I am worried that this problem will get worse rather than better. But I do applaud those who focus on, as you do, on return on equity, and like to see more of that.
Lawrence, I want to say thank you so much for coming back onto the show today. I want to hand it off to you, let the audience know, you know, where can they learn more about you, your book. And I also, please feel free to share any public talks that maybe the audience can sign up for Berkshire, because there's going to be a lot of members, including myself, who are going to be attending that event.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks, Kyle. Well, I think the best way to get in touch with me is on LinkedIn. I'm present there. I don't post prolifically or every day, but I put ideas up there and have conversations and followers. And so that's probably the easiest way. And there are links there to some of my stuff. For the book, obviously, here's a picture of it. I've got my dog-eared too. So you want a dog-eared. And for that, you can buy it anywhere. And I don't mean to single out a particular retailer, but Amazon has this book and has other books, including Dear Shareholder that Kyle mentioned. So feel free, connect with me on LinkedIn, visit the books. I was on a show, another interviewer recently said, Larry, it looks like you've written, five books? And I said, well, I've written 20, but five of them are good. And so this is the best one. So, because it's mostly not me, it's mostly Warren, and I just rearrange it. So, and visit Amazon to pick it up. I will be at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting in early May 2024. I've been to most of them since 1996 or seven when I first went. It's gotten bigger every year, more interesting. First one was, I think when I first went, 6,000 people in a basketball stadium. And last year, I mean, 35-ish thousand in a rock arena. And all the related activities have also blossomed. So back then, I was the first person to sell a book at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting. And it was the essays. It was Warren's idea. He invited me to come with my nephew. And he said, you should bring some books. You can set them up outside the jewelry store where shareholders gather and sell them. So I did. And now lots of things are sold at the Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting. From cowboy boots to Coca-Colas and lots of books. And so I will be at a good place to say hi to me if you'd like. I will be at the Bookworm. That's the bookstore that it has a concession inside the annual meeting. It'll be open Friday and Saturday, and I'll be there almost all day Saturday in and out of the meeting. So please say hi. I'd be happy to. He sells books at a discounted price. I'll be there, signing copies of this one. For those who are coming, if you got another minute, for those who are coming a long distance or out of town and get into Omaha on Thursday, which will be a lot of Australian guests and from the East, there is a wonderful annual event called the Berkshire Summit that's hosted by Bob Miles, a friend of mine, Berkshire author, great guy, and he's the impresario of this gathering where there's a different theme each year. This year, the theme is going to be Charlie Munger, who passed away in November. So a tribute to his life, his contributions to Berkshire. So I'll be speaking at that on Thursday morning. Get in touch with Bob. I'm at a lot of other events over the weekend, so I'll be around. So feel free to say hi if you've been with Kyle and are inclined to say hi. I'd be happy to speak with you.
Okay, folks, that's it for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you back here very soon.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow We Study Billionaires on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.